In a one-night special TV event, Oxygen brings to life Payne Lindsay's hit true crime podcast, Up and Vanished. In 2016, Payne took a deep dive into the disappearance of Tara Grinstead, a young teacher who vanished 13 years ago. His podcast has reached over 240 million people, and Payne is still at work, determined to bring closure to Tara's small town. Don't miss Up and Vanished, a one-night special TV event. Catch up on Oxygen on demand.
Mandalay Bay Security Dispatch, we have an active shooter in room 32135.
32135?
Yep, 32nd floor, Mandalay Bay, 135.
On Monday, September 25th, 2017, 64-year-old Stephen Paddock checked into his suite on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. He had also booked the adjoining room to the suite, and 4 days after that initial check-in, he checked into that room too, using the name of his girlfriend. Paddock spent the next 7 days going back and forth between those hotel rooms and his home in Mesquite, Nevada, about 80 miles away. According to video surveillance, he appeared to be a normal Las Vegas tourist, playing video poker, buying snacks at the gift shop, chatting with hotel staff, and eating at the hotel restaurants. But all the while, each time he left the hotel, he would return with multiple suitcases and bags, and each time the bell staff would assist him in wheeling them up to his rooms. But unbeknownst to the bell staff, and to the unsuspecting hotel guests and tourists who passed them on their way, the suitcases and bags, 25 in all, were filled with weapons and ammunition. On October 1st, 2017, a week after he had checked in, Paddock used those weapons to shoot from his window on the 32nd floor, down to the crowded music festival that was taking place below, just across from the hotel. He killed 58 people and injured over 700 before turning one of his guns onto himself. When police finally figured out where the shooting had come from, and when they finally stormed into his room, Paddock was already dead. And around him were 23 guns and thousands of rounds of ammunition. In August of this year, less than a year after the massacre took place, the Clark County Sheriff's Office announced that they were closing the investigation, and perhaps what would be one of the most frustrating aspects of the case was that no motive had ever been found. It was the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. But it wasn't the first time that someone had opened fire on an unsuspecting Las Vegas crowd. 10 years earlier, in 2007, the New York Hotel and Casino, also located on the Las Vegas Strip, experienced its own terror. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 63. On July 5th, 2007, 51-year-old Stephen Zagrian got into a cab, headed towards the Las Vegas Strip. Despite the weather that night, at midnight, temperatures were recorded at 102 degrees Fahrenheit. He was wearing jeans, a white shirt, and a long trench coat. Leaving his cell phone behind, he got out of the cab at the MGM Grand Hotel and started walking. He walked up and down the strip, finally using the walkway connecting the MGM Grand to the New York Hotel and Casino. It was 12:40 a.m. when he arrived at the New York. He started pacing on the second floor of the hotel, overlooking the casino floor. A pair of escalators were just off to his left, and he watched as dozens of people passed by him to go down to the first floor. Back and forth he paced as he watched. Then, at 12:43 a.m., Zagrian went to the edge of the balcony and took out a semi-automatic handgun from his trench coat pocket. He pointed it down at the casino floor below and started firing. The casino was considerably crowded that night, with an estimated few hundred people milling about, gambling, drinking, heading to one of the casino's bars or restaurants, or simply walking through. Keep in mind that Las Vegas is an all-night kind of town. When the gunshots started, chaos took over. People were screaming and running, trying to take cover, even though it was hard to tell where the shots were coming from as they echoed through the casino. Zagrian emptied the clip and went to reload, but his gun jammed. Surveillance video shows him turning around and calmly walking back towards the walkway where he came from. 24-year-old Justin Lampert, a U.S. Army reservist from North Dakota, was standing nearby. He had heard the gunshots, which at first he thought was coming from one of the gambling machines. He quickly realized the gravity of the situation when dozens of people stampeded past him in a desperate attempt to escape. He noticed the older, bearded man, dressed in the long trench coat, his hair disheveled as though he had just gotten out of bed, and he immediately became suspicious. The man was way too calm, contrasting the hordes of people who had been running and screaming after the shots first rang out. And then he saw the gun in the man's hand. He watched him for a few seconds as he walked by, and then the man turned towards him, and they locked eyes. The man attempted to reload his gun, and that's when Justin saw his chance to pounce. He ran over as fast as he could and tackled the man. The two men fell to the ground, wrestling. The gun fell from the man's hand, and another man, David James, a Navy reservist from Florida, ran over and grabbed it. Justin and David were able to subdue him until just minutes later, when Las Vegas Metro police officers and security guards arrived on the scene and swarmed the casino. Stephen Zagrian was handcuffed and taken into custody. As the injured victims were taken out of the casino to the ambulances waiting outside, people clapped and cheered for them. Luckily, no one was killed that day. Four people were hit by the gunfire, while one person was injured when she was caught in a stampede as people ran for cover after the shooting began. Zagrian was charged with 5 counts of attempted murder, 4 counts of battery with a deadly weapon, 16 counts of discharging a firearm in an occupied structure, and 1 count each of burglary with a deadly weapon and carrying a concealed weapon. There were 52 felony charges in all. He was held on $4.6 million bail and was placed on suicide watch. Las Vegas Police Captain James Dillon told reporters that he was absolutely certain that terrorism was not involved. He said Zagrian was emotionally distraught and that his family members had called the police the day prior, on July 4th, and said they were concerned that he was suicidal. Officers had responded to his home, but they had determined that the allegations were unfounded. When investigators interviewed him, Zagrian told them that he had lost his job and had gambled away all of his money while wandering around the strip in a suicidal depression the day before. He told them that he had been hoping that police would kill him. But even though there was really no question as to who fired all those gunshots in the crowded casino, Zagrian pleaded not guilty and was facing up to life in prison at his trial. Stephen Zagrian's trial started in July 2009, 2 years after the shooting. Prosecutor Ravi Bawa told the jury that Zagrian had entered the casino with 249 rounds of 9mm ammunition. He said he had 5 magazines with 16 rounds each, all loaded to capacity. He also had a speed loader and another 200 rounds of loose ammunition.
He goes in there with the intent to kill. That's what his intent was. He manages to fire off 1 magazine full into the crowd below. He's in a position, he's at the high ground. He's looking over a balcony, firing into the crowd, firing at people. And you can see him aim and push out toward people and follow and track people as he's firing. And he empties that magazine. And then he gets up and he starts walking on the upper level. And you can see him aim at another person. And he's trying to fire the gun, and it jams. And that's why nobody's dead. Not because he was feeling merciful, not because he caused enough panic, not because of any other reason. Because his gun jammed. That's why.
He recounted for the jury how an Army reservist tackled him and threw him down to the ground, and how another reservist was nearby and tackled him too. No one died, but not because of the defendant, he said. The jury would be hearing from the victims, and they would be watching the surveillance video where a figure in a trench coat could be seen on top of the balcony, firing a gun into the crowd below. Firing to kill, he said. In her opening statement, one of Zagrian's defense attorneys, Bita Kamzi, told the jury that they're here because of a tragedy.
We're here, ladies and gentlemen, because of a tragedy that occurred on July 6th, about 2 years ago. And it is a tragedy. It's a tragedy that people were scared. It's a tragedy that people were frightened and people were hurt. But it's also a tragedy in another sense. And we're here to tell you about the depression and despair that drove Stephen Zagrian to this point. To the point where all he wanted to do was die. To the point where he wanted Metro officers to kill him, commonly known as suicide by cop.
She said they wouldn't be denying that Zagrian shot the gun, but said the jury needs to determine what crimes he actually committed. She said the state will have you believe that he went in there to kill innocent bystanders, to kill lots of people. But if you look at his actions and at what he didn't do, you will see he didn't have the intent to kill anyone. Jeff Narveson, a surveillance supervisor at the New York Hotel and Casino, was the first witness to take the stand for the prosecution. He described the casino's surveillance room as a room with about 30 monitors that surveil the entire hotel and casino. There are about 4 people watching the cameras per shift. Narveson said he was working on the night of July 5th into the early morning hours of July 6th. He was watching the surveillance videos in real time when at 12:43 a.m., he saw a man standing at the balcony overlooking the casino, firing a weapon down to the bottom floor. That surveillance video was played for the jury. You can see a grainy figure on the balcony overlooking the escalators, watching as dozens of people pass right by him. Then, suddenly, at 12:43, you see people running, scrambling to get off the escalator. One woman crouches behind a pillar as the shooter then walks right by her. He walks towards what looks like the exit doors and is then tackled by a man wearing a white shirt. They scuffle on the ground for about 15 seconds before more people run over and help subdue him. Narveson told the court that the casino was relatively busy that night. A young teenager named Troy took the stand next. He was 13 years old at the time of the shooting, from California, and was in Las Vegas with his mom. They were visiting his older brother, Reggie, who worked inside the New York, as an operator of the roller coaster that snakes through the casino. On the night of July 5th, he said he and his family went to see a movie, and then he and his brother went to ride the roller coaster while their mom watched. They had just gotten off the roller coaster and were heading over to Nathan's hot dog stand. When they got to the bottom of the escalator, he heard what he thought was a firecracker. People started running all around them, and the noises got louder and faster. He quickly realized that they were gunshots. His brother knew of an employee room where they could go for shelter, and as they were frantically running towards it, he got shot in his ankle. He said he fell to the ground, and his brother had to drag him the rest of the way to the room. He said his leg felt like it was burning. After the gunshots stopped, his brother went to find their mom, who they had lost in all of the chaos, and pulled her into the room too. He said he went to the hospital and was given morphine and a prescription for painkillers. When he got back to California, he had to see a doctor there too. He wore a cast for a few months and had to use crutches. About a year later, he had to have a procedure done to remove the bullet. He recalled how they had to have someone hold him down because it was so painful. He said he still has vivid memories about what happened. Another victim, Carrie Zarevica, was very emotional when she took the stand. She told the court that she was a dance teacher from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that she was going to school to become a respiratory therapist. In July 2007, she went to Las Vegas on vacation with her boyfriend and her 2 cousins. She said that at about 12:40 in the morning on July 6th, she was inside the New York casino, about 20 steps from the escalator, about to go up. Her boyfriend was holding her hand, and her cousins were in front of them. They were on their way to the walkway that would take them back to the Excalibur, where they were staying.
And as you're heading toward the escalator, and I know this brings back some memories, what happens?
We were walking, and me and my boyfriend, like I said, were holding hands, and we heard pop, 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 and I stopped, and I turned to him, and I said, "What was that? It sounded like a firework." And before I even got the whole word out, it was like constant shots again. And I went to turn because I felt like it was coming up from the left of me. So I went to turn to the right. And when I went to step on my leg, I had no leg to step on. And I realized that I was shot. So I was just trying to get somewhere so I didn't get shot again. Just trying to get behind something.
And when you say no leg to step on, I mean, is that
completely numb, like, you know, when your leg is asleep.
Right.
I didn't have I fell almost to that side because I didn't have a leg to step on. I
couldn't control it or feel
nothing. Yeah.
Understood.
She tried to drag her leg behind her so she could get behind a slot machine.
Well, why are you trying to get behind the slot machine?
Because I didn't want to get shot again. The shots were still coming at that point. It was still firing.
And you can hear where they're coming from?
Yeah, I felt like it was coming up from the left.
And you're at the base of the escalator at this point?
Yeah, I was about 20 steps back from the escalator, yes.
The bullet went through the side of her left knee and came out of the top of her calf. She said everyone was screaming and running, and that all she kept thinking was that she had to get behind something. People were running into each other and jumping over slot machines. She lost track of her boyfriend for a time, but then found him and her cousins again. She said they hid for about a half hour when a lady who was an EMT from Colorado stopped to help her. She said she was in excruciating pain at that point and was taken to the hospital in an ambulance. Carrie told the jury that her leg is now paralyzed. From her knee to her toes, she still doesn't have feeling in it. She said she can't teach dance anymore. She had been dancing her whole life and then was teaching at a private dance studio. But now with her leg, she can't do it. Her injury also affected her schooling. She said it took her a year longer to finish school for respiratory therapy. She couldn't stand on her leg, and so she had a hard time with her internship. She was in too much pain. She was on pain meds for the first 3 to 4 months and said she still takes over-the-counter meds whenever she has to stand or walk. She said it also affects her job, even now. Most respiratory therapists work 12-hour days, but she said she can't stand for that long. When asked if she's able to work in the emergency room, she said no, because she can't move fast enough. She can't walk without wearing a brace. She can't control her foot or any of her toes. And without the brace, she said she would trip and fall. She said her toes also keep getting infected from her poor circulation. And in addition to all the physical agony, it affects her emotionally too.
Have you sought any kind of counseling or help with dealing with the emotional aspect of it?
I've spoke with my priest at church.
What are the issues that you're having?
I hate being in large crowds of people. I'm always nervous. I always want to know where the door is so I can get out. I absolutely hate going to the movie theater. For the first 3 months, I was scared to be by myself in my own house. I was very scared. I had to have to be with someone 24/7.
Michael Rowe, an officer with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, testified that he was dispatched to the New York Hotel and Casino after receiving a shots fired call. When he arrived, he saw Zagrian on the ground with a couple guys on top of him, wrestling with him. He said he handcuffed Zagrian and walked him over to a nearby bench. He had visible injuries to his face and head from the scuffle. He said Zagrian asked him for some water, and so he got some for him.
All right, did you read him some rights?
Yes, I read him his Miranda rights.
And after you read him his Miranda rights, what was his story?
He began to relay that he came to the New York in order to have the police department shoot him, commit suicide by cop, He said that he began to shoot throughout the casino and did not have an attempt to make it to the door. In his mind, he didn't think he was going to make it out because the police was going to stop him before he got there.
Did he say what he was depressed about?
He lost his job. He lost his marriage. He was losing his house. He just had been depressed over some years and didn't want to go on any longer.
He said Zagrian told him that he had been screaming at the top of his lungs, "Come get me, come get me," while he was firing. Zagrian also told him that he had purchased the gun at a gun store a few days prior, and when asked if he knew who had stopped him, he said no, that he was walking towards the door when he was attacked by someone who was trying to be a hero. On cross-examination, Officer Rowe said the first thing Zagrian asked him was whether or not he had hit anybody and if everybody was okay. He said that he didn't care anymore, that he was done. He also told Officer Rowe that he had been up for days and needed water. Justin Lampert testified next. He told the court that he's been in the military since June 2000 and that he was with the Army National Guard. In July 2007, he was in Las Vegas with some friends for a bachelor party. On the night of the shooting, he and his friend William were at the top mezzanine of the New York casino, eating hot dogs. He said they were planning on going to another nightclub when they heard a couple pops. He saw what he estimated to be about 100 or 200 people running towards him, trying to flee the area. He identified Steven Zagrian at the defense table and said that after the gunfire stopped, he saw him walk by, going in the same direction as the crowd. He said Zagrian had both hands on a pistol and looked like he was manipulating it. He couldn't tell if he was reloading it or what he was doing, but he was using both of his hands.
At some point, do you make eye contact with this person?
Yes, sir.
And does this person, the defendant, does he say anything to you?
He doesn't say anything at that point. He gets to almost right. Ooh, I touched a couple more. But he gets right past that last kiosk. Such as right there.
Okay.
And I was right there. He gets just past that kiosk, and I don't know if he heard something within the room that I was looking, or that I was in. William took off. I don't know if that's what he heard. I'm not positive. But he got past me to my 11 o'clock, and then he turned around and saw me. And as soon as we kind of locked eyes, I instantly took off. And as I took off, approximately 10 to 15 feet away from each other, he said he was going to effing kill me. And then,
why don't you give me the exact word? We need to know what he said.
His words out of his mouth was he was going to fucking kill me.
As he's looking at you.
Yes, as I was running directly at him. And then once it got to that point, I didn't really have a choice. So I jumped on him and tackled him. As soon as I tackled him, he lost the gun. And I put him in a chokehold. He kept on squirming back, trying to fight to grab the gun. And as soon as I got him in the chokehold, I started yelling for help. Because I realized as soon as he comes free, if he gets that gun, I'm not going to have a very good day.
How much do you weigh?
I weigh about 185.
Did he weigh a little more than you?
Yes, sir. Okay.
He said Zagrian squirmed out of his chokehold and leaned back towards the gun. He thought the man was grabbing for his gun, so he reached down and pulled on his face to get him back. That's when another guy ran up and took the gun away. More people started running over, and he walked away from the area as the others got it under control.
Now, let me ask you this. You heard all these gunshots. You see people, hundreds running to the door, stampeding to the door. And then you see the defendant with his gun. What's going through your mind at this point?
At first, it was really kind of surreal because I didn't. It was weird to understand what was going on. But after I saw the defendant and just what he was wearing, he just seemed completely out of place considering the situation and the environment. He had a trench coat on, hair was really disheveled, and then the gun just kind of capped everything off, making it more obvious of the situation.
Right, and then what he said to you, what were you thinking?
Basically, once he said that to me, I was already too far engaged to actually have any. It didn't really make a difference what he said to me at that point, because I was already involved in taking care of the situation. Obviously, it added a lot more understanding what truly was going on, but that's about it.
Did you think it was him or you?
Definitely, sir.
He said he didn't hear Zagrian say anything as he was firing the gun. On cross-examination, Zagrian's other attorney, Lynn Evans, asked him about the discrepancies in his testimony today versus what he had told investigators after the incident that night.
Being the conscientious person that you are, you attempted and tried to be as complete and accurate as you possibly could, correct?
Yes.
Now, given that set of situations, would it surprise you to learn that at no time, either in your handwritten voluntary, nor in the recorded statement that you gave to the police, did you indicate that Mr. Zagrian turned and looked at you from any distance and said, I am going to fucking kill you? Would that surprise you? Given the fact that this is an important event in your life, the words are still ringing in your ears, it was incredibly dramatic. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me for the fact that I was trying to put down the events and I was never told, or I didn't feel that was a vital point at that time.
Wasn't a vital point. The fact that somebody had threatened your life wasn't vital.
We got the information out is where I was trying.
And the very last question that the detective asked you in that recorded statement was, just to make sure that they had everything. Because they didn't, maybe they didn't ask you what he said, correct?
Correct.
The very last question that that detective asked you that night was, is there anything else that you can tell us of importance that would assist us in our investigation of this matter? Is that true?
I believe so, sir.
Okay. And you still, at that point, couldn't recall that that man, according to you, at 10 feet, according to your testimony, squared off with you and told you, I am going to fucking kill you. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
On redirect, Justin said that after the shooting, they were given blank forms to write down what happened. He said he's not a talkative person, but that he answered any questions that were asked of him. When testifying before the grand jury, he was asked if Zagrian had said anything to him, and he said yes, that he said he was going to fucking kill him. As you'll recall from earlier testimony, shortly after Justin tackled Zagrian, another man ran over and took Zagrian's gun away. That man was David James. David was also in the military and was also in Las Vegas for a bachelor party. He testified that on the night of the shooting, he had just arrived at the New York Hotel and Casino, where he and his friends were staying. He dropped his bags off in his room and then went right down to the casino floor. He recalled being immediately suspicious when he first saw Zagrian prior to the shooting.
When I actually thought something might be wrong was when I first laid eyes on the guy.
When you saw it?
When I first saw him. Yeah, because, I mean, I'm from Florida, and it was like 130 degrees out there, and somebody's wearing a trench coat. I'm like, if he's not, I just thought that was kind of weird in the first place.
Where was he when you saw him?
Well, he was by the slot machines.
Can you indicate on this diagram where
It's not showing it because you would have to be, it would be on a lower level this over here, and they got some slot machines in this area, and he was playing slot machines in that area when I first laid eyes on him.
And you thought there was something unusual about him because of the way he was dressed?
Yeah, just the way he was dressed.
And it's July in Las Vegas?
Yeah.
All right.
David said he went up the escalator to the second floor, and he and his friend went to Coyote Ugly. It was really crowded, so they walked back out. While he was walking, he started hearing gunshots, and at first, he thought it was all part of a Las Vegas show. He started walking towards it and was confused when people started ducking and running, including his friend who was with him. And that's when he saw Zagrian again in front of him. This time, Zagrian was leaning over the balcony, shooting with a downward motion. He said it didn't look like he was aiming at anybody, which is why he still thought that it was a show. The shooting stopped when Zagrian ran out of bullets, and then he said Zagrian looked at him.
So we're looking at each other eye to eye, and I'm still like waiting. Where's the big, the big happy ending or whatever? But
what happened then?
he dropped the clip out, and he just reached down in his pocket, pulled out another clip, and he was still looking at me, and he started shooting at the ground. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm in trouble.
So what'd you do?
I tried to back away. You know, I kept my eyes on him because he was still looking at me. I was still looking at him while he was firing, and I just backed off.
He said he then saw who he now knows as Justin Lampert tackle him. He said Justin was screaming for help because Zagrian was bigger than him. They were rolling around on the floor, and so David ran over and grabbed the gun. Zagrian was biting down on Justin's fingers at that point, and so David started kicking Zagrian in the head until he let go. And then another guy came over to help. David said he took the gun and moved away, crouching down, so people wouldn't think he was the shooter. Prosecutor David Schubert played the surveillance video again, and David pointed himself as well as the shooter out on the screen, explaining again what happened. On the screen, there's a point after the shooting had stopped and when Zagrian was walking towards the door. He stops and points his gun at someone who is off screen and then continues walking. Prosecutor Schubert asked David if he saw that happen, and David said no, that by that time, he had backed away and was no longer watching him. But a few minutes later, David said he was the person Zagrian had pointed the gun at. He said that afterwards, he thought maybe Stephen wasn't trying to kill anyone because he could have shot him when he saw him. On cross-examination, Zagrian's attorney, Lynn Avance, wasted no time in bringing up that discrepancy. He pointed out that only after David reviewed the videotape with the prosecutor was he saying something different than what he initially told investigators.
Now, for the first time, sir, here today, you're telling this jury in this room that after you reviewed the videotape with Mr. Schubert and about how the events kind of play themselves out, that you now suddenly recall today, 2 years later, after looking at this videotape, that that gentleman pointed a weapon at you and put your life in danger. That's your testimony, correct?
Yes.
All right. And you also told us earlier, not 5-10 minutes ago, that was incredibly important, and that was basically a life-changing event, correct?
You, life-changing in what?
It was important to you, correct? Somebody was putting your life in danger.
Yeah, it was.
Because at first you thought it was just a show.
Yes.
Correct? But then later on when Mr. Schubert asks you, now this person is pointing a weapon at you, correct?
Yes.
And the first time we're hearing about that is today. The very first time. Correct?
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Yes, I can actually. The way I would explain it is, I never got a chance to actually see the tape. So a lot of things that I'm saying, I might have had the timing wrong, but that's what actually had happened. Now I didn't remember him actually pointing a gun at me because I might have blocked that out. And the only reason why
I'm there.
Okay.
So your testimony is here today that because it was so traumatic, that event, that you may have blocked it out of your memory bank.
Well, yeah.
Is that what your belief is as you sit there today?
Yes.
April Jackson testified that she was in Las Vegas in July 2007 with her husband and some friends. On the night of the shooting, they were at the New York casino. She was playing slot machines, and her husband and his friend were at the craps table.
And while that's going on, around 12:40, does something happen?
Yes.
What happens?
I heard a bang, followed by another bang. Didn't know what it was. And then I heard a third bang, and then I felt something hit my arm.
When you say hit your arm, where did this thing hit your arm?
On my left elbow.
How did it feel like?
It was burning afterwards. I just kind of felt it hit. It's kind of in shock, so.
She said she got scared and dropped to the ground to protect herself. She ducked behind a machine, although she wasn't sure where the shots were coming from. Everyone around her ducked down too. When she heard the gunfire stop, she ran around and started looking for her friends and family. And finally, she came across her husband, who had been frantically looking for her. She said her gunshot wound to the elbow was a minor injury, but that it was painful. She said the shooting has emotionally affected her, too. She's paranoid that this will happen again, and more scared about what her husband does for a living. He's a police officer. Fernando Maestas was also a victim. He said he was celebrating his 30th birthday in July 2007 in Las Vegas and was staying at the New York, New York. On the evening of July 5th, he was watching his fiancée play the Wheel of Fortune slot machine at the base of the escalator of the casino. He heard the first gunshot and immediately knew that it was a gunshot.
When you heard it, what did you do?
I actually tried to see what was going on. Everybody else started running and ducking under tables. I've been deployed before with the military, so my immediate response is just try to help. And my body just didn't really respond the way I should have. So I actually stood around. And probably about 3 shots were fired off after that. And then I was actually grazed by maybe shrapnel or fragmentation.
At that point, when you get grazed, do you know from which direction the gunfire is coming from?
Actually, I heard the bullets ricocheting that were getting closer to my position that I was in. And from that point, I didn't know where they were coming from. They were sounding like they were hitting all over the place. But they were definitely getting closer to my position. I could definitely hear that.
Are you still just standing there?
I was standing there until I was grazed, and then I took cover with everyone else.
He said he was hit on his right hand. Detective Fred Merrick was the lead investigator on the case. He testified that he transported Zagrian to the Clark County Detention Center and was there when the corrections officers searched him. He said they found what he called a suicide note in his police report in one of Zagrian's pockets. The note was scrawled on the back of a receipt for a shooting range. The receipt was from the American Gun Club in Henderson from July 2, 2007. At 4:54 p.m., just 3 days before the shooting. The receipt was folded in half. On the back of the receipt, on one half, it read, "Thank you if you shot me. Thank you, fuckers." Then some words are illegible, and then it reads, "Oh, I'm lucky bastard in the office, my," and then there's another illegible word, "They still alive. I was very mad, and I want to kill everybody in this office. Lucky bastard." On the other half, it read, "Am not killing myself, stupid cops." He said after they interviewed Zagrian, he learned from Officer Rowe that Zagrian was not happy that the police had been at his house. In fact, he was mad because he said they were monitoring emails that he had been sending to his brother, who lived overseas. So Detective Merrick obtained a search warrant to search his home. They seized his computers and looked for emails, but nothing of value to the investigation was found. On cross-examination, Detective Merrick said they did an investigation of Zagrian's entire hard drive and didn't find a manifesto, a declaration of intent, or anything saying that he was going to kill a bunch of people. Attorney Lynn Avance pointed to a man in the surveillance video who was close to Zagrian on the escalator and asked if Zagrian could have shot him easily if he had wanted to, and Detective Merrick said yes. On redirect, Detective Merrick said he no longer considers the note a suicide note. We'll get into the defense's case right after this quick break from today's sponsors. I've colored my hair a lot over the years, going back to when I was a teenager. My natural hair color is dark brown, but I have had everything from brown to pink to even purple, and now to blonde. So if you get bored with your hair color like I do, you might just love my sponsor for today's episode, Madison Reed. Madison Reed was founded in 2013 by Amy Arrett. The company is named after Amy's daughter, and it's on a mission to revolutionize the way women color their hair. For decades, women have had two options: Either color your hair at home with outdated at-home hair color, or go to a salon where it takes a lot longer and is way more expensive. And this is so true. I used to color my hair from home all the time, but I could never get it to look or feel like I just came out of a salon. So Amy created Madison Reed because she believes women deserve better than the status quo. Madison Reed is reinventing the way women color their hair. They offer the quality of salon color, the convenience and affordability of at-home hair color, and combine that with an ammonia-free formula with ingredients you can feel good about. When you're done, you'll look like you just came from a salon, but really, you've just had more me time to do what you love. Experience beautiful, multidimensional hair color, made in Italy, delivered to your door, on your schedule, for under $25. Join the hundreds of thousands of women who have tried and loved Madison Reed. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. And check this out. Madison Reed is giving Court Junkie listeners 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit with promo code JUNKIE. That's promo code JUNKIE at madison-reed.com. And one other thing before we get back into Steven Zagrian's trial. Many of you wonderful listeners have reached out asking how you can help support this podcast. And honestly, you listening, sharing, and subscribing helps me out immensely. So thank you for listening. And if you don't mind, please consider telling your friends, family, and even those people who annoy you at work about Court Junkie. And please be sure to click on that subscribe button in Apple Podcasts or the follow to subscribe button in Spotify or wherever you normally listen to podcasts. Okay, enough self-promotion and back to the trial. The defense called one witness to the stand, Dr. Thomas Kinsora, a clinical neuropsychologist. He said he assesses people's brain functions and personalities. In this case, he studied the surveillance footage, police reports, witness statements, and medical records. He interviewed Zagrian on two different occasions for a total of about 7.5 hours. They talked about his life history and then narrowed their discussions down to the days between July 4th and July 6th. He was asked to describe Zagrian's demeanor when he spoke about the shooting.
You know, first, I will state that clearly anyone who spends any time with Mr. Zagrian can see that he continues to be very, very depressed. So he comes across as a very depressed gentleman. He continually calls himself a loser and stupid. And when we begin to talk about this particular event that occurred, he seems to be just beside himself as to what he was thinking and how. My impression was he had. He's dealing with the fact that people were hurt, and I don't know that going into it, he thought through that.
Okay. So
there's a remorse level that's there that actually worsened the depression currently, which he hasn't really received any treatment for.
Dr. Kinsora said he also talked to Zagrian's two daughters, who were 20 and 22 years old at the time of the shooting. He said the first daughter he spoke to, Christina, described her father as loving and hardworking, and recalled how he used to take them camping, fishing, and bike riding.
But then, did she notice a change? And was that of significance in your formulating your opinion as far as...
Absolutely, absolutely. A marked change. When his wife asked for a divorce in, I believe it was 2003 or something like that, he tried to stay a very active father, and he was very positive for a while, but then in a couple years before this all happened, so we're talking like around 2005 and stuff, the kids were getting older. She had moved out, and so she was visiting him more. She was an adult now. She wasn't visiting as much. He became more and more sullen. He took the divorce very, very hard. He took the separation from his kids very, very hard. And they began noticing that he was drinking. So they would go over there, and he would never drink when he was there with them, but they noticed bottles that he had been drinking before.
And how is that significant?
Well, it's significant because what we're seeing now is we're seeing a man who was
a very happy father and whatever else, is now deteriorating. And over the course of 2 years, it gets really bad. I mean, this man begins drinking a lot. He's having trouble finding work. He's becoming more and more depressed. He's got chronic medical conditions that are causing a lot of pain. And the family is seeing him slowly deteriorate. And like most families, they sat there and watched it, and they talked about what do we do. But like most families, you don't do anything, and then something happens.
He said Zagrian's other daughter, Andrea, said the same things about her father. Dr. Consora said he administered a personality evaluation, which consisted of 567 true or false statements. He said it looks at whether or not the defendant is trying to pull one over on them, also known as malingering, which is an attempt by someone to pretend there's something wrong with them when there isn't. He said Zagrian seemed to be very forthright and showed no signs of malingering. He then told the jury about Zagrian's psychosocial history, saying that in order to assess him, he needed to know where he came from. He said Zagrian was born in Budapest, Hungary, and grew up under a very repressive regime. When he was about 26 years old, he moved to the United States. He had been writing back and forth with a woman named Mary, and within 5 months of being here, they got married. Dr. Consora told the court that Mary was the love of Zagrian's life. They had 2 children together, and when she told him 23 years later that she wanted a divorce, it was particularly devastating to him. He worked as a painter, and in the 1990s, his physical issues, including a rheumatic disease and back problems, affected his work. He started having trouble finding work, and tensions between him and Mary grew due to financial issues. As their divorce was finalized, they put their house up for sale, and later, he found out that Mary was dating the guy who had helped them sell it. After Mary, he met a woman who was living in Las Vegas who needed to become a citizen, and so they got married. The woman switched all of his credit cards to her name, cleaned out his bank account, and within 8 weeks, she was gone. This greatly contributed to his depression and drinking, Dr. Consora said. A little while later, Zagrian went to Hungary for 4 months to visit his mom, who still lived there. He paid a company to rent out his house and to collect the rent money and then make house payments for him. But instead of making those payments, they took his money and kept it, and so his house defaulted. He went to an attorney and asked for help, but no one would take his case. Then the homeowners association asked for a huge amount of money in late fees. Zagrian tried to talk to them and was very angry about that. This was towards the end of 2006. Dr. Consora said the DSM-4 is a guidebook they use so that everyone is diagnosing a similar disorder using similar criteria. According to the DSM-4, Zagrian has major depressive disorder.
In the months leading up to July 5th of 2007, how would you characterize that depression at that point?
All right. Now, again, some of this is recreating, talking with his daughter, his daughters, but it was either toward the very end of 2006 or the very beginning of 2007, we see evidence of a profound depression where he begins talking about, I'm not sure I can live anymore. Making statements like, I don't know how much longer I want to live. And that increased significantly as we moved toward June. And then as we moved toward the end of June, you know, it became so bad that, of course, the family called the police to have them come out because they were worried he was going to kill himself.
We're talking about July 4th.
So, I mean, it culminated up to where, you know, you could see it building just in his responses. And you can see it also building within his emails to his brother, which become increasingly less fixed on reality. You start to see him saying that he thinks maybe his phones are being tapped and maybe they're listening, they're reading his emails. So, now, that's moved to another level of depression. That's called major depressive disorder with psychotic features.
Okay, and let me just stop you right there. When you say that someone is suffering from major depressive disorder with psychotic features, does that mean that they're psychotic?
No, not quite like that, because, I mean, when we think of psychotic, we think of schizophrenic, and it's not the way it is. There's some similar features to it, but any of us, if we leave our depression unchecked and it cascades this way and it's not stopped, if you don't kill yourself first, you will eventually, or most of us will eventually end up with some sort of psychotic symptoms. And also what we mean by psychotic is that reality starts to not quite be logically based anymore.
Okay, and so in this case, I think you're referring to his paranoia?
Yes.
And the paranoia, thinking that that somehow the government is tapping his phones and reading his
correct.
Email.
And what I had said in my report is he's a little more prone to that than you or I because he grew up in a government where that happened. You know what I mean? So that step into, while they're even doing it here in America, is a little bit easier step than for you or I to start thinking that. It's a much bigger step for us because we didn't grow up in a government like that. So
he said Zagrian needed medication, psychotherapy, and alcohol treatment, none of which he received. He noted that in his opinion, Zagrian is still a suicide risk because he has never been treated. Dr. Consora then listed out the things that affected Zagrian's decision-making the day of the shooting. His chronic alcoholism, the lack of sleep he said he had, his dehydration, and lack of food. He said Zagrian told investigators that he had been wandering around the strip and hadn't eaten anything or had any water in 2 days. He had only consumed alcohol. Dr. Consora said that Andrea talked to her dad on July 3rd, and that after talking to him, she was very concerned.
And he was saying things that made her sound, that made her feel like, oh my gosh, my dad is suicidal. She drove all night from San Francisco, got to Las Vegas at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, I don't know if she took a nap or whatever, but they agreed to meet at 3 o'clock. They met at Taco Bell. This is on July 4th. Now, this is after the police have already come and talked to Stephen to ask him about suicide and to determine what, to try to help determine whether he was going to commit suicide. He meets with his daughter. Initially, he's trying to be cheery, but then gets very somber and basically tells her that she's not going to see him anymore. He tells her that he wants her to have his dog. He wants him to have all of the stuff in his apartment.
Was that significant?
Well, this is, you know, between that and what he had already told other family members in terms of trying to give stuff away, this spells all over suicide.
That night, Andrea went to work at the MGM, but kept thinking about her father. She tried calling him, and one of her father's friends, who is also a cab driver, picked up and told her that he had left his phone in the cab, but that he had been on his way to see her. He said she tried looking for him, and he was trying to look for her that night as well, but that they didn't cross paths. Dr. Consora was asked about the significance of him looking for his daughter that night.
When you look at the case later on, there's multiple things that they do for somebody to come in and stop them. Because there's a healthy part of us, And there's a part that's bent on destruction. And when you become profoundly depressed and suicidal, most of what you are is wanting to die. You want somebody to put you out of your misery. But there's a little bit that maybe is wanting somebody to save you. And I find it really interesting that he's dropped off right across from where his daughter worked. And this is where all this stuff ends up going down, you know? And here his daughter's looking for him, doesn't find him. And it makes you wonder what would have happened if his daughter, none of this would have happened. We wouldn't be sitting here right now. I don't know. But in any case, he wasn't stopped. You know, no one saved him, basically. And then, obviously, the course of events began to unfold.
Zagrian's attorney, Bita Kamzi, asked if there was anything that would indicate what his intent was that night, if he had been intending on killing people.
My conclusion is, in looking at all of this, everything from talking to him and his family history and his daughters and all the other information, the video, my belief is that he did not intend to kill. His only intent was to get killed. His intent was to raise a panic that would allow somebody to shoot him to put him out of his misery. That is what he wanted.
Dr. Consora said the suicide note shows his intent too, that he clearly stated that he expected to die from gunfire. He said that if Zagrian did want to kill anyone, it would have been the members of the Homeowners Association who had stolen his money. That's who he says Zagrian was referring to when he referenced the office in his notes. But he didn't kill them. Instead, he wanted to kill himself, so he went to where he thought he could get it done. He noted other things that indicated Zagrian's lack of intent to kill people. He said just before Zagrian started shooting, he walked over to a man who was seated on a bench nearby and said, "Are you tired? Maybe you shouldn't sit here. You really need to leave." If he had wanted to kill someone, that guy would have been a good target since he was so close. But instead, he protected the guy. Dr. Kinsora also pointed out that Zagrian didn't go into the casino when it was the busiest. In fact, he had told investigators that he had gone in there a few times in the hours prior, but had seen children there and said it was too crowded. So instead, he chose the middle of the night. He also didn't appear to be aiming at anyone. There were people on the escalator right in front of him and at a craps table that he could have taken aim at, but he didn't. When asked to describe Zagrian's personality, he said from all accounts, he was a hard-working family man. He was never demeaning to his kids or had any sordid history of spousal abuse. There was also nothing to indicate that he was a sociopath.
You're talking about, I mean, I think before you were talking about someone actually going, you know, aiming to try and kill people. You're talking about someone that's more like a sociopath. Is that correct?
Exactly.
And this is not anything that you saw in this case.
No, and this is what that shifts this case to, in my mind, to say this is primarily a mental health case. This is primarily a case of profound depression and suicidal behavior in which he engaged in reckless behavior and people got hurt, and thank God nobody was killed. And thank God the guy that tackled them because he might have been killed by the police in the end, had it gone on any longer.
He says Stephen Zagrian is different than other defendants he has worked with.
He was devoted to an upstanding life. He was devoted to his kids and trying to keep a happy family life when they were growing up, trying to work hard to bring money home to them. Very affectionate in a lot of ways. He's very soft-hearted. If anybody, and it's too bad juries don't get to spend time and talk with some of these folks that are defendants, but he's very soft inside if you spend any time with him, emotionally very soft. He can be brought to tears easily. He's very sentimental. And there's not that coldness that you see, or at least that I see in working with some of the defendants that I've been called in to see, where there's that sort of distance and inability to bond with other people. You don't see that with him. He's mushier than that emotionally, I guess.
On cross-examination, prosecutor David Schubert immediately pointed out that Dr. Kinsora usually testifies for the defense in cases and not the prosecution. And in addition to that, Schubert accused him of only having talked to Zagrian and his two daughters to make his assessment of him.
In your report, you only rely on information that is given to you from the defendant himself, who is facing 52 violent felony charges, and his two daughters, who are clearly supportive of him. Isn't that true?
No, that's not.
Who else did you rely on?
Well, I relied on a volume of other information that was detectives questioning him, videos, witnesses.
That has to do with the case. I'm asking as to the information that you got from Mr. Zagrian. Mm-hmm. Did you talk to anyone else or look at any other source to verify what he was saying to you was true?
Once again, I used all that information to determine whether what he said to me was true. I'm not sure what you're referring. I mean, because all of this incorporates a little bit of everything I've seen, and you're making it sound as if everything in my report was based on what he told me and his daughters told me, and that's simply wrong.
Well, you've painted a very rosy picture of the defendant, and the evidence doesn't paint a rosy picture about the defendant. Mm-hmm. So where did you talk to anyone else that is unbiased that would corroborate anything that the defendant has told you?
Again, I didn't talk to somebody, no one in person. I read transcripts of the guy he was living with, the little bit on the police. Well, we don't really have much on that, and the police who went over to talk with him about suicide that day. So, I didn't talk in person with anyone else.
Schubert brought up that after talking to investigators, Zagrian became angry with them and thought they were listening in on his phone calls and looking at his emails. Dr. Kinsora countered that that's part of the diagnosis, but that he doesn't see a whole lot of anger there. Schubert then focused on the note that Stephen had in his pocket, where he says, "motherfucking cops," and pointed at that as being angry. Dr. Consora finally conceded that he was angry, but didn't include it in his report. Schubert then told him that Zagrean had been lying to him.
You mentioned that you got some information from Mr. Zagrean that he tried to sleep but couldn't for days. You recall that?
Yes.
Is that your direct testimony? Would it surprise you to know that he had a home to live in and go to sleep right up until July 5th, the night of the crime, and that's when he moved out? So he was not up and out and dehydrated and without sleep and without food for days. Would that surprise you?
Well, it would surprise me if he went home on July 5th.
Would it surprise you to know that he was home on July 5th, and in fact, he moved out on July 5th?
So I'm getting my days mixed up. So it was July 5th, or July 4th, the police came over, if I'm correct. July 5th, he was the night of July 5th, he moved out, I believe.
So he's angry on July 4th at the police. July 5th, he moves out. The night of July 5th, he falls off and opens out gunfire in the New York hotel.
Schubert pointed out that Zagrean had multiple fully loaded high-capacity clips and over 150 loose rounds to reload those clips after he emptied them.
Does that still make you think that he was suicidal?
Absolutely.
What did you think he intended to do with all of that ammunition?
I don't think he's real clear on what he intended to do. I know that he had bought the ammunition. He had a few days before. He had, and I know that he intended in a standoff with the police that would end up in his death. I don't know. I don't believe that there was intent that innocent people would die.
Dr. Consora said in his report that Zagrean did not meet the legal criteria for insanity. So Schubert said, he knew right from wrong, right? Dr. Consora said yes, but that he used poor judgment and made very reckless decisions. Schubert then told him that it's clear that his report is biased.
I don't believe it is, no.
You don't believe it?
I don't believe it is. I believe it brings the psychological aspects of what we're going on in the best summation of my analysis of what I've seen. I mean, if I was going for him, I would say he was completely needed to be hospitalized and he wasn't thinking right and he wasn't responsible for his behavior, and I could have done that, and I didn't, did I?
Well, you went pretty darn close.
Oh, I'm pretty far away, actually. That's a big difference.
In his closing argument, Prosecutor Schubert said that Zagrean only got off 16 rounds because his gun jammed and that his intention was to reload the gun and continue to fire. He was thwarted in his attempt, he said. He went over the charges and explained to the jury why they should find Zagrean guilty of each one. He explained that 16 of the counts were for the 16 rounds that Zagrean had fired. One of the counts was from when he pointed his gun at David James and tried to shoot him, but the gun jammed. The battery with use of a deadly weapon charges were for each of the victims he shot: Carrie, Troy, Fernando, and April. And then there were the counts for discharging a firearm in a structure. He said there was no other shooter in the hotel that day. He showed photos of the casino with the empty shell casings all over the ground, photos of the damage done to the casino, and photos of the injuries the victim suffered. "We're asking you to find him guilty on all counts," he said. In his closing arguments, Stephen's attorney, Lynn Avance, said the state said something in their closing arguments that shocked him. They said that one of the counts was for when Zagrean pointed his gun at David James and tried to shoot it, but it jammed. He said David James lied about that in court.
He lied to you, ladies and gentlemen. It wasn't truthful. It added drama to the story, but it wasn't truthful. And, you know, I mean, it's not a malicious thing. Maybe some people, they don't know what the importance of that's going to be to a case. They don't know the legalities of the things that we're discussing. They're not lawyers. They're not people that study this kind of thing. But facts do make a difference. Facts do make a difference. And something as innocuous as saying that people don't understand maybe what the implications of what they're saying at the time that they say them. Well, they won't care about that. Everybody's having a good time with my testimony. Well, that was important. Because the state just told you, we solved the crime based on Mr. James's testimony. And that's incredible. And if you buy that argument, I got beachfront land in Arizona to sell you. Because that man was not telling you the exact truth about what happened that night. And you're here to determine what was the truth.
Avant said this case is about what Zagrean was thinking, his specific intent, what was in his mind, and that as reckless and dangerous as his actions were, he thought his actions would result in his death. The jury deliberated for about 4 hours and then returned their verdict. They found him guilty on all charges except for one of the attempted murder charges. At his sentencing, Zagrean asked for forgiveness from his victims. "I know I will go to prison," he said. "If anything, it was my cry for help, to end my own life." He was sentenced to 26 to 90 years in prison, more than what was recommended in the pre-sentencing report. After the trial, Zagrean's attorney, Lynn Avance, said he was disappointed in the verdict, but that the trial at least gave the judge and jurors some insight into Stephen Zagrean as a human being. But in April 2010, 7 months after Zagrean was sentenced, he died of a heart attack while in his jail cell. And in 2011, just 2 years after prosecuting this case, Clark County Deputy District Attorney David Schubert ended up with a criminal record of his own. He pleaded guilty to felony possession of a controlled substance after police officers pulled him over and recovered cocaine from his vehicle. He was placed on 3 years probation that would include 9 months in the Clark County Detention Center. But instead of turning himself in, as he was scheduled to do, Schubert fled the area, and in fact, fled the country and headed to Mexico. And what's even more bizarre, he reportedly posted a photo of a deserted beach on his Facebook page, as though he was taunting law enforcement. Ultimately, he did return to the United States and served 5 months of his sentence. His bar license was revoked. He could no longer practice law. And in July 2013, he committed suicide. A friend of his spoke to reporters and said that he was a very, very good lawyer and will be dearly missed. And that's all for this episode. Let me know what you think about this case. Do you think Stephen Zagrean went to the casino that night to kill other people? Or do you think he was only trying to get the police to kill him? Do you agree with the verdict and sentencing? Let me know by joining my Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com, or tweeting me at courtjunkiepod. I also have an Instagram at courtjunkie, which I'm going to be a lot more active on shortly, so be sure to check that out. Court Junkie is also now on Spotify, so if you use Spotify, make sure to find Court Junkie and subscribe. And don't forget, Payne Lindsay's hit true crime podcast, Up and Vanished, comes to life in a one-night special TV event on Oxygen. 2 years ago, Payne began exploring the shocking disappearance of a young teacher and former beauty queen named Tara Grinstead, who vanished over a decade earlier. Payne is still at work searching for the truth. Don't miss Up and Vanished, a one-night special TV event. Catch up on Oxygen, on demand. As always, thanks for listening. Until next time.